And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm glad to welcome Michael Ferris-Smith back to the program today. Michael is a novelist from southern Mississippi, and his first book was the novella The Hands of Strangers. In 2013, he broke out with the near-future ecological dystopian novel Rivers, which won the 2014 Mississippi Author Award. Today, we'll talk about his new novel, Desperation Road, which is published by Lee Boudreau Books. The book opens up with an unnamed older man spotting a woman and child walk along the interstate on a hot summer day, and it turns out the book is not his story.
Yeah, that's true. I think the old man is influenced by the same thing that influenced me to start writing the story, and that was the image of the woman and child on the side of the road, with the woman carrying the garbage bag over her shoulder with everything they own, and the very hot Mississippi day, and I think he was struck by them. The same way I was struck by them when I had the idea for them. He's concerned about them and scared for them. And so many cars have passed him up until that point, he just can't help but turn around and help them. And he immediately, like, as soon as he drops them off and helps them out, he can't remember what he was trying to do in the first place. And that's kind of how I felt about Mabin and Anna Lee, too. When I first had that image for them in my mind, I just wanted to, you know, wrap my arms around them and hold on to them and try to keep them from whatever was coming next, although I knew probably a rough life was about to get even rougher.
I mean, that's such a difficult position to be in because, you know, someone in that position walking along that has had a lot of troubles, and are you inviting those troubles into your life if you stop to help them out?
That's right. I mean, it's a risky proposition. I mean, even if not from just the physical risk that you may be encountering, but just an emotional risk. But he has empathy, and I think that's one thing we seem to be, empathy seems to be under siege these days in our country with the climate of everything that's been going on. And I think the old man has that, and I think all writers they do have empathy for their characters too. And he was willing to stick himself out there to help, even though it's going to affect him emotionally. And I think you know, we could use a lot more of that in fiction and in life and all the way around.
Well, I think empathy is in short supply because so many people haven't hurt like almost everyone used to back in the day. You know, privation isn't nearly as widespread as it was. So, you know, you can't get to empathy, so you got to access sympathy. And then, you know, there's something weird about sympathy in that it can make you angry at the same time.
That's true. I think that's a very good point. You know, I don't know where that kind of, where the slip has come up, but it seems to be so prevalent. It seems like, you know, a lot of big voices that we get to listen to or have to listen to are too busy complaining about other people instead of figuring out how to help other people. I think that's where we're missing the boat big time. And it's probably not any surprise these are the kind of people I'm writing about.
And it's the old thing of pointing out the splinter in someone else's eye and ignoring the beam in your own.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, being the son of a Southern Baptist preacher, that's always been in my mind. You know, I've had that lesson taught to me since I was a little boy, and I'm very grateful for it. And it's a lesson I try to pass on to my daughters now.
Yeah, you open up with an epigraph from Isaiah, chapter 58, verse 10. And if you spend yourselves in behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will rise in the darkness. Your night will become like the noonday. And considering how the Washington Post changed their subtitle here recently, it seems very appropriate.
Yeah, absolutely. Too appropriate, I'm afraid.
Like with this man that picks up Mabin and her daughter Anna Lee, you do give quite a few of the smaller characters in the book their own point of view chapters instead of just folding them into the point of view of the two main characters.
Yeah, I think that's something I've just kind of learned over the years in writing novels and writing you know, longer pieces is that everybody that walks into a novel, you have to treat like a real person. To me, there's no such thing as just a fly-by character. Even if they're in and out for just a few pages, I want to give them a face and a voice and maybe something a little memorable about them so that they become very real to the reader. I think I first kind of came to that with Rivers because the question I had to answer for every character in Rivers is why would they possibly want to stay down below the line with all the storms? I mean, because that's the first thing you would ask anybody who did that. So I really had to flesh out every single character in that and kind of answer the why and what are they doing. It seems like it might have carried over some with the work I'm doing now. How even the people who just come in for a few moments, I want to treat them as real as just as anybody else.
Now, with Rivers being a realistic approach to a speculative future, How is that different experience from writing the new book, which is very much rooted in realism all the way through?
It was a very different experience. To me, though, Rivers was always very kind of, and I don't want to say realistic because of the dystopian, you know, notions of it and the climate change and the storms and all, but I always felt like I was writing like a Southern Gothic novel when I was writing Rivers, and I was very surprised to see the reactions to it right off the bat and all the different genres it was listed under. Desperation Road, I like that it started in this moment with this woman and child, and it is present day, and it is hot in Mississippi, and I liked being kind of back in the true form of home versus the speculative form of home. And plus, the roads down there where it said in Macomb and Magnolia and Pike County, that's where I went to high school, and I rode those back roads many nights with friends and acquaintances, and I like the idea of grabbing hold of that moment. And, you know, not a lot of time passes in Desperation Road. I think it's 4 days maybe. So I like the intensity of being in the moment.
Now you mentioned it's 4 days, but there's been a lot of years that have led up to these 4 days.
That's right, yeah. It's been 11 years since Russell has been gone. He's been in Parchman and comes back home. And Maven's been gone for a while, too. When she and Anna Lee come walking back into Mississippi, she's been gone for a while, and there's been a lot of tough stuff in between. And besides just the Russell and Maven, you know, we meet the brothers pretty soon who have been had this day marked on their calendar for a while, and they're ready to get back at Russell for killing their brother so many years ago accidentally. Revenge is patient, you know. Their revenge is very patient, and they want to dole it out in the only way they know how. So while the story itself is very compact, I guess in a matter of 4 or 5 days, it's been building up for a long time.
Yeah, but their patience was enforced. You know, they couldn't break into Parchman and settle
right.
the score.
That's right. You know, it seems like, you know, they say time heals, but for these guys, time has not healed at all. If anything, it's made Larry just boiling. Every time I sat down to write Larry, I couldn't wait to see what he was going to do or say next.
You just kind of think of like the arms on a clock spinning around, and the tip is just barely pointed down and just kind of wears and scores the skin as the hours just go by.
That's a very good image. I might borrow that sometime.
Maben, when she's left, her fortunes have risen and fallen pretty much depending on the quality of man she was with at any given time.
Maben hasn't made the best decisions. That's much as obvious. But it seems to me like Maben's finally deciding to try, and I know the child has a lot to do with that. When I started this story, it would have been one thing to just had Maben on the side of the road walking by herself. But when I put a child in her hand walking along beside with her, that really raised stakes and consequences quite a bit. And it really attached me to it emotionally, having two daughters of my own. She's made a lot of mistakes. And I guess the kind of question I was trying to get at is it ever too late to right the ship? I don't know. I like to think not. She's scratching and clawing through to the end. But a lot of it she's brought on herself, which we have a tendency to do.
And she's headed back to Macomb, and it's not because of any promise of family or help from friends. It's almost like a salmon swimming back upstream.
Exactly. I mean, she doesn't really have any idea why she's heading there, and I think the old man kind of has that comment in his mind, too. When he picks him up, she says, "We got to get to the Fernwood truck stop," and a mile or two down the road, just looking at them in his rearview mirror while they're in the back seat, he realizes they don't really have any idea what they're doing or where they're going any more than I do. It was where the trail began for her so many years ago, so I don't know.
Before I did a little bit of Wikipedia, and the only thing I really knew about Macomb, Mississippi, is the home of Bo Diddley.
That's right. Yeah, we have a blues trail marker down there by the railroad tracks and a little Bo Diddley pavilion. I say we. I haven't lived there. I guess I had left out of there when I was about 20. My grandparents stayed living down there for a long time. They just passed away, you know, not long ago. And my wife's family is from there, too. So we're down in there a couple times a year. But there's Bo Diddley, and there is, I'm not sure.
I saw Britney Spears was born there.
Britney Spears is actually from, went to high school there. She's from Kentwood.
But she was born in Macomb and raised up in Kentwood.
Yeah, raised in Kentwood. And then she went to the school there in Macomb, to the private school.
I've always thought border towns, they seem such like unusual places.
Yeah, and I can attest to that being from down there. That region down there along the Mississippi-Louisiana line, it is a little different. People are a little different. Like, I don't think I realized this a whole lot till I got away from it. I would meet people in college or even now meeting someone, and they find out you're from down there, and they would just roll their eyes and shake their head and say, oh, God, I used to know some people from down there. And then they go on and tell me so many stories about them or the way they interpret people from being down there. And it's funny because when I was in high school, we even sensed it a little bit. I remember a good buddy of mine used to always say, you know, down there along the Mississippi-Louisiana line, we aren't rednecks and we aren't coon asses. So he began to just call us affectionately coon necks. And I said, I saw him in Macomb the other night, and we had a nice laugh about being a bunch of coon necks. So
I guess that's better than being a bunch of red asses.
Yeah, that was the, you know, better of the two for sure.
Also saw that it had been kind of a flashpoint for both the labor movement strife and for civil rights violence too.
Yeah, Macomb was at least at one point, like a lot of places across the South, was a big railroad town once upon a time. And my wife, some of her kinfolk were, you know, involved with the railroad. And, you know, it's been a hotbed for a lot of things. I think probably some of that has to do with that vibe, that South Mississippi vibe and Louisiana vibe that just, you know, personalities are a little different.
Because it's south and hot, but it's not on the Gulf, so you don't get the cooling breeze, and so it's just oppressive.
You get the mosquitoes and the humidity, and it is oppressive. That's a good way to put it. But you can always drive over into Louisiana and through a drive-through daiquiri place and relieve the heat, which people still don't believe those exist when I'm in other parts of the country. They're like, you can do what in Louisiana? I said, yeah, you can get a drive-through daiquiri.
Now, are they like the barns where you drive through the middle of a barn like they have in North Carolina?
Yeah.
They're like that?
Yeah, they drive through and... I mean, my wife's family has a camp down in Vidalia across the bridge from Natchez, and we were there last summer, and I drove through one of those places, and in one stop, without getting out of my car, I got a 64-ounce daiquiri, two Jell-O shots, and a fifth of rum, and took it back to the camp before people start calling the police on me.
I worked at a chain of liquor stores in Arkansas, mm-hmm. and at the flagship store. In Arkansas, you can have drive-through liquor stores, but it's just kind of like a fast food place.
Yeah.
But we would serve people cups of ice, too, on request.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one fellow came through, and he says, yeah, I'll take a half pint of Crown and a can of Coke. And later I learned it's called a Black Tooth Grin by Diamond Darrell from Pantera. But he poured the entire half pint in the cup of ice and then just put a splash of Coke on top and... He said, do you want the rest of the Coke? And I said, I'll take it.
Yeah, it takes all kinds. And those places, I think all kinds drive through those kind of places all the time.
And speaking of drinking, Russell doesn't take too long until he starts committing parole violations as soon as he gets back home.
Yeah, you know, he does. And he falls back into it pretty quickly. And I think a lot of it has to do, and I think this is probably the first time I've thought of this, with getting jumped right off the bus. You know, if that doesn't happen, maybe he doesn't realize what he's really stepped back into. And maybe he doesn't go off on this kind of falling back into this path that got him in trouble in the first place. I mean, who knows? But
he had a tough time while he was in, too.
He had a tough time. And fortunately, I've never spent 11 years in Parchment or 11 days. But I can imagine coming out of that. And the thing, too, he comes back to a place that's very much changed. You know, Macomb looks different to him. There's strip malls. There's all kinds of things that weren't there before, convenience stores and restaurants. It doesn't look the same. And then his mother has passed away, and the woman he was with before has married and has children and moved on. So he comes back to a lonely place, I suppose. So, you know, if your idea of enjoying yourself or trying to relax or trying to get out of your own head for a little while is to throw a cooler in the back of the truck and go out, I'm sure he was probably thinking about that a lot in the days before he got home. And then to be pounced on by Larry and Walt right off the bus pushed him pretty quickly back into some old habits.
Yeah, those Tisdale boys, I mean, they just said, okay, this is how it's going to play out. Yeah. And there's this inevitability about it.
Yeah, they're serious. It just seemed very real to me, too. Putting those guys there, leaning against their truck with their arms folded, waiting for the bus to pull up and for Russell to step off. I thought that just seemed to me so real and how it would likely be. And I think part of that, too, and I'm talking about myself now, but, you know, I'm bad to hold grudges. You know, I've always been bad to hold grudges, and I've tried to stop being that way so much as I've gotten older. And I think I probably have changed a little bit, but particularly as a younger guy, teenager, younger man, I was pretty good at, you know, holding on to things and having little check marks in my mind.
Was that just our Scotch-Irish heritage that
does
that?
I don't know, you know, and I've been warned about it, and I've been, you know, people have tried to talk me out of it, and I don't know. It's always been a part of me. So writing those brothers was believable to me because I think there was a little bit of me in their nature of, we're not forgetting anytime soon.
So I was watching Frozen with your daughters, encourage you to let it go.
Remarkably so. Sometimes
what's the last thing you're able to let go of?
Oh, let's see. Man, I didn't expect to be put on the spot like this. I don't know. Maybe I'll email you later once I have a chance to think about it.
All right. Sorry to put you on the spot there.
My wife will tell you nothing, but there certainly has to be something somewhere.
You know, I think that ought to be an aspect of Book Talk in the future, that we get the writer's partners to come in and talk to them a little bit too and get a fuller picture.
I think those would be some fascinating conversations. And honest to God, I think the writer's partners would probably find a lot of camaraderie and comfort in hearing what the other ones had to say.
We've just discovered a new format.
We actually have. You could start a whole new series.
Now, when Mabin and Annalie get to the truck stop, they don't have a whole lot of money, so they have to make some hard decisions on what they're going to do with that limited cash.
Mm-hmm. I love characters who are at the end of their rope, and I learned this early as a writer from writers I admire. You know, Larry Brown and William Gay and Harry Cruz, right from the get-go, there seemed to be this sense of, you know, desperation and just already this bruised and bloody knuckles from these characters just trying to get out of whatever hole they're in. And Mabin is at that truck stop, and she has no answers. I mean, the only answer is to keep walking tomorrow and hope something else works out. But now she's made the mistake, and it's not really a mistake to spend all the money. But they had to have a motel room for the night. They've been sleeping in the woods for, you know, days, her and the child.
Getting chewed on by mosquitoes
and scratched from briars and things on the side of the road. And she looks out the window and she sees an answer in the parking lot there. And it's nothing she wants to do, but it's
something she's done before.
And it seems like the only thing that will propel her and the child for another 24 hours. So she sets out to do it, and she changes her mind, but just the taking the step to do it leads to a lot more trouble.
In the vernacular of a truck stop, it's known as being a lot lizard. It's a prostitute at a truck stop.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And she looks out the window and notices it happening and thinks, I could do it, and I could at least feed us for a few more days.
And unfortunately, someone inside the truck stop saw a couple of other girls doing it, called the deputy sheriff to come and take care of the problem.
Which he does, and he has a history of coming to take care of the problem and taking advantage of the situation himself. And when Mabin, who is innocent, who doesn't go through with it, turns around and heads back toward her room, he's sitting there watching her, but he doesn't know that she hasn't done anything, and he's out to take advantage of it. I mean, one of the most heartbreaking scenes to me of the book is when he throws her into the back seat of that car and begins to drive off, and she's begging him. I didn't do anything. And then two, I have a child back there, you know, and this is a child that's living a very rough lifestyle already. And a child who probably is in fear of abandonment at any minute. And for Mabin to have actually made a good decision where she's made a lot of bad decisions before, and then to be paying for it immediately and to be begging for mercy because she has a child back there, and for him just simply not to believe her and really not care either way. That was a tough one for me, but it kept ramping the stakes up higher and higher to where I didn't know how she was going to get out of it or what was going to happen. And I think as a writer, that's where I want to be. I want to be in that moment where I have no idea how this is going to play out.
And unfortunately, with the recent immigration raids, we've been seeing this play out on our televisions every night.
Absolutely. I think it hits pretty close to home. I mean, we see these people who are kind of just there. They're everywhere, and there are a lot of issues concerning that now. I think it's very close to home, and we circle back around to empathy again. I mean, where you see these people, there are children also somewhere, and there are a lot of people out there living, hanging on to the bottom of that rope, trying to pull themselves up in tough spots that are probably, you know, not much fault of their own.
Back with Russell, you keep the particulars of his crime you don't reveal that until quite a ways into the book.
Mm-hmm.
Was that just to create a dramatic tension, or was that to kind of emulate the way he's trying to put that out of his mind and he's not thinking about it? What purpose did it serve to let us know later on what had gone on?
I think probably both of those things, just kind of the slow burn working up to it, and also him trying to separate. I mean, he Russell feels like he's paid his debt to society. He doesn't feel any less guilty over, you know, driving drunk and killing that boy 11 years ago, but he feels like he's paid his debt. And, you know, I think part of the reveal for myself too was me realizing somewhere there, probably a third of the way into the story, how Russell and Maven were connected. And I just wanted to kind of creep up toward that moment and burn it out. You know, one of the things that I love about the writers I admire is how their novels feel like almost, you know, when you peel an onion, it's just got layer after layer after layer, and you get closer to the center, it just gets smellier, and you get to where you're going. And I really like that feel of kind of that burn, you know, through. So it's probably a combination of several things, but I knew their paths were going to cross, and when it occurred to me that was how it was going to happen, I was careful about where I wanted it to land.
As you referred to the Southern Gothic before, just that sense of inevitability just hangs over everything.
Yeah, it's like there's a cloud, you know, there's always that cloud, like the little cartoon character that walks around with the gray cloud over his head. And yeah, inevitability is a good way to put it. You just know, you know something's coming. And I think that helps me as a reader propel me from chapter to chapter. And I hope as a writer that does the same thing for my readers. You know, another thing I've learned about writing novels over time is use the ends of those chapters to your advantage, man. I love ending a chapter where even myself, I can't wait to turn the page and get to the next one and start writing the next sentence to find out what's going to happen. And I think that helps with that inevitability and that propulsion some.
Well, and you've taken another key from the thriller writer, and most of the chapters are fairly short. Most of them are under 10 pages. There are very few chapters that go over that far.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I hearken back to myself as a reader again, because that's what I like. You know, I like those really contained moments that carry a punch with them. And I think part of it, too, is, you know, I get bored pretty easily. So I try to make things happen. And I feel like I'm getting a little sleepy with it, you know, then certainly the reader is going to. So maybe I don't feel like you need a whole lot of words to create a really emotional and complex and gut-wrenching type of story. I think using the shorter chapters or having the shorter chapters maybe does help kind of thumpity-thump it along the way.
Well, it's almost like that end of the chapter is an underline saying, this is important.
Right.
And constantly saying, okay, we've got moments here. Pay attention to these moments.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good way to put it. Yes, pay attention. You don't want to miss it.
There was something unusual that I noticed in it, too. You would start a bit of dialogue, and every once in a while, you would have a narrative description of the beginning of the conversation and then fall into regular reported speech with quotation marks. I was just wondering, I saw that device come up a couple of times. Why'd you start off with giving a summary of the beginning of the conversation, then going into the rest of it, regular style?
Yeah, I don't know that I have a real answer for that other than I just let it come out the way it comes out. I mean, I'm a big believer, and I don't want to make this sound simplified because it's not on any level, and any writer will tell you that, but I'm just a big believer in just letting it come out the way it comes out. And I try, when I sit down to write, I try to relieve as much anxiety of the whole thing as I can. You know, we were talking earlier before we went on about putting your phone aside. I want it to come out the way it comes out, and if it feels good to me, I'm not really going to question too much the technicalities of it, I guess, so to speak. I'm real interested and hopeful for the lyricism of language, I think, above anything else. And then whatever follows in that notion of, you know, kind of the musical, melodic quality of the language and of the sentences is just, I don't know how it lands. I don't think too hard about it. Unfortunately, I don't have an editor who thinks too hard about it either.
And it's a pretty stripped-down book. You don't spend a whole lot of purple prose in there.
Elmore Leonard had some great writing advice once upon a time. He said you need to leave out everything the readers would skip. And I don't know. That's obviously been a bit of writing advice that's stuck in my head for a long time. And try to hit the image. Hit the image, write actively, and keep trucking.
Now, the people Russell left behind when he went into jail have suffered from his absence, and none more than his father.
Yeah, I thought the father gave me a moments of tenderness in an otherwise story that is pretty, it's gritty and those things. But him and his dad, they get to sit on the back porch and they get to watch the sunset and they get to kind of be father and son again. His mother's passed away while he's inside, and his father has moved on in some ways with taking up with Consuela, the Mexican woman who has come to live with him. And it's a dad and a son who kind of, I think a little bit too, and what I liked about their relationship is it kind of falls back right into probably where it was. I mean, they sit down pretty quickly and they don't talk a lot about what was it like. They don't talk a lot about how's so-and-so doing, and they don't bring up any other names. They don't really bring up a lot. They pretty much fall back into, hey, how you doing? I'm pretty good. How are you? Won't you come help me slide this ladder over here underneath? Sure, Pop, no problem, you know. I thought there was an honesty in their relationship that I appreciated and that I really enjoyed, like, being a part of and sharing in.
For some strange reason, the detail struck me. Mitchell, his father, had a pond out back, and he stocks it with catfish and has to feed the catfish in order to keep them going so he can eat them later. And I just thought that was a really nice image.
Yeah, thank you. That was, we did that as a kid. My grandfather had a catfish pond, and I mean, one of the fun things to do was to get a cup full of catfish food for me and my sisters and go and throw it out and watch those big mouths slowly come up out of that brown water and just engulf and take in the catfish food. And I don't know, it makes it, I guess it's cheating to feed them so that every time a hook hits in the water, they think it's feeding time. But yeah, I mean, part of that too was me getting to revisit those moments that I've experienced too. And it felt nice out there at his place.
There's a hatchery up in southern Missouri we would go to. Just, it was a real pretty area. It's near a state park. And they had it figured out because kids could pay a quarter and get some feed to throw to the trout. They were supposed to be stocked in the rivers, so they didn't even have to pay to feed the fish. The kids would pay it in order to get to feed them.
Yeah, I bet they got a lot of quarters.
Yeah. I will have to say my favorite scene that just struck for the painful realness of it all was when Larry went to go see his son play Little League.
Mm-hmm. That was Larry, for me, getting to the point where he just couldn't take it anymore. You know, we talked about Mabin and the mistakes she's made and Russell and the mistakes he's made, but Larry is a walking mistake too, and you can feel the regret in Larry also too. And I think this has been a part of me also trying to treat everybody as a real person, and that nobody's bad all the time and nobody's good all the time. And that scene when Larry goes to the ballpark after he's already been out to his ex-wife's house once and tried to see the boy, and you know he probably hasn't seen him in a while anyway. You know, he's just triggered to go do it, and she won't let him. I mean, that was, you know, him reaching out, and really, I guess, the only way he knows how to do it, very overtly and very kind of brusquely, with the same result he keeps ending up with, you know, multiple times.
He has not learned to alter his approach in the slightest.
He has not learned. He knows one way, and that's put your head down and go very hard forward.
Now, my favorite exchange of dialogue, I won't give away who's talking to each other. It happens a little bit later in the book. But one character says, "Bad shit happens to good people." And the other person responds, "Nah, I'm not a good person. I ain't a good person. Bad shit happens to everybody. I wish to God to take a break when you're trying, though."
Yeah. Yeah, I like that bit, too. You know, I know a lot of people, and rightly so, talk about, you know, my work being dark and bleak or whatever. But I think it's about courage and love, probably, more than anything. I mean, you got to have courage to keep going when things go bad. And in life, you find out about someone when they're facing hardship. You find out about the character, what someone's made of, about their emotional makeup when things are tough and when things are hard, when they're hurting emotionally, when they've got heartbreak, or just when they're down, or when something unexpected happens. And for me, it's the challenge I put on my characters, you know. How do you act? How do you react when things go bad? You know, what are you made of? How much courage do you have? You know, how much guts do you have? Are you going to get back up, or are you going to quit? You know, emotionally, spiritually, psychologically, however, you know, it's not just a physical sitting down and giving up. I mean, we all know that emotional giving up is way more crippling. So it's like that in life, and it's the challenge for us in life to keep going through the tough things. And I give that to my characters. You know, you're going to go through some tough things, but at the end of the day, how strong are you going to be? And I thought that strip of dialogue there, I think, speaks to that whole idea of that for me.
In the book, there's a bar called the Armadillo they go to, and there's a band playing covers in there, playing Skinner and George Jones and Bo Cephas. And here you are sitting in front of me with a Ramones t-shirt, so reconcile that.
Well, you need to listen to all kinds of music, I guess, is the best way to reconcile that. I kind of saw the Ramones one time. There's a lot to that story, but I was in Amsterdam, and I'll leave it at that. I kind of saw the Ramones one night.
You may perhaps weren't conscious of the fact of...
Maybe. Like I said, that's the cliff notes. But music, I mean, you need to listen to all kinds of music, same reason you need to read, you know, different kinds of books. And music's become a bigger part of my writing life in recent years. I always have 4 or 5 songs playing in my head whenever I'm working on a particular novel, kind of a soundtrack. And I'll drop my girls off in the morning at school, and then I'll ride around and listen to those few songs before I go work, which is first thing in the morning. And the Ramones and Skinner, I think the thing they have in common is they weren't playing around. They were going headstrong, and I appreciate that quite a bit.
Well, what were the 5 songs going through your head while you're writing Desperation Road?
I've been listening to Jason Isbell a lot the past couple of years. And
which writer in the South has it?
I know it. It's hard not to. I mean, his lyrics are just so, they hit you in a place.
And Elephant is just an incredible song.
God. Traveling Alone off Southeastern was the big song that I listened to a lot. I mean, it has just this kind of really just long, kind of longing quality to it. And then I've also listened quite a bit to some older country in the writing of Desperation Road. I listened to some He Stopped Loving Her Today for some reason was on my mind when I thought about Mitchell and the Father.
Well, you could think about Russell and his...
You could think about Russell,
and,
too.
And his fiancée he left behind.
That's right. And then Simple Man, I think, was another song that... It's hard to remember. It's been 2 years since this manuscript was turned in. But I think Simple Man was one, and I remember listening to George Jones, and I remember definitely listening to Traveling Alone. I think that was the very first one every morning I put on as soon as the girls hopped out of the car. Because they got tired of listening to it. And then, two, it really just helped kind of calm me down and get me ready to write and go try to be creative.
So what have you been listening to for your next book?
Well, you're going to make the same comment, but I've been listening to Chris Stapleton because everybody else has. But the song that struck me the most for writing The Fighter was Fire Away off his, I guess, only solo album. Fire Away was the one I just popped in immediately. Again, it just has that desperate longing. Give me everything you got. I can take it, and I'm still going to handle it. You know, I'm still going to fight through it. And that's the characters in Desperation Road. It's also the characters in The Fighter that's coming out next year.
And I should let you know, the last of the Holy Trinity of modern country for writers,
Sturgill
yeah. will be up in Memphis for the Beale Street Music Festival.
I saw that the other day. I saw that, yeah. Yeah, Sturgill's good, too. I listen to Sturgill all the time. And I kind of lap back around in the Drive-By Truckers and some of their earlier stuff, too. Another song I listened to by them, Hell No, I Ain't Happy. I mean, that pretty much fits the mode of what I got going on.
I love that song. There's a World of Hurt.
Yeah, yeah. And their lyrics,
and
too,
that,
man.
That, that song, I think, fits the book pretty good.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. I need to get me a playlist together. I'm heading across to Georgia and the Carolinas and Nashville and New Orleans in early March, and I just need to get me a road track.
Need to throw up a link, a Spotify link on your webpage for the...
That would be a good idea. Those would be a good couple songs to put on there. But yeah, the Truckers, they're, what I admire about them, too, and always have, is they're very, use a lot of strong images, and they go right to the point, you know, which I think is good advice for anybody trying to write a song or a poem or a novel or whatever.
Now, you mentioned you'd turn in the manuscript for Desperation Road a couple years ago. You're a change in publishers. What's it like being with Lee Boudreau now?
It's a lot of fun being with Lee Boudreau. I've never had a boring conversation with Lee Boudreau, if it's been 30 seconds or 30 minutes. Lee is just so enthusiastic. You know, there weren't a lot of editors in New York I was real, you know, familiar with. That could just name off the top of my head. But when my agent called me and said that Lee was the first one to reach out to us, I was ecstatic, and I would have walked to New York to work with Lee. She, you know, has worked with a lot of writers I admire, but, you know, she does Southern stuff, but she really has a varied list, too. And what I love about Lee is kind of what I was talking about with when I write dialogue, or, you know, I just love the way it comes out, and however it comes out, if it works, it works. And if it breaks 100 rules, so what? If it sounds good. Lee is very, I think, similar in that she's just really about how something works or doesn't work and how it sounds or doesn't sound. It doesn't matter what kind of novel it is or who it is writing them. I mean, her tastes are varied, but I think she follows her heart, and I think she follows her gut. I have a tendency to do the same thing, so she and I seem to be speaking the same language these days.
What can you tell us about The Fighter for next year?
The Fighter is set in the Delta. I've spent some more time over in the Delta in recent years, having made some friends there. I'm always very intrigued by it anyway. I mean, every time I drive over into the Delta, and anybody who's done this or spent time there knows when you come over whatever the final hill is, you come over from whatever direction, and that land flattens out, and it just becomes that flat land and that desolate and those empty highways, and then you get in these towns, and it's just a really interesting place to me. It's got a different, very different vibe, I think, from anywhere else in the world I've ever been. And I've been, you know, I've traveled around a bit and lived in a lot of different places, and something was just, you know, had been kind of tapping me on the shoulder and saying, you know, this would be a great place to write something, because I love writing landscape and place so much. And so when I had the idea for Jack, who's a 40-something-year-old busted up old cage fighter who's got some real problems and owes some bad people a lot of money, and who has made, like the rest of them, made mistakes of his own, and he's trying to tie this one particular relationship with his foster mother back together. I thought, what better place to have him trying to put all this back together than in the middle of the Mississippi Delta.
A little bit of that Harry Cruz influence coming back
there. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Mike, I want to thank you so much for stopping back by. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, yeah, I'm very happy to be back. Thanks for having me.
Michael Ferris Smith is the author of Desperation Road, which is published by Lee Boudreau Books. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.